Good morning, dear friends. Hope you were able to enjoy some rest last night, and gratitude for the schedule that provides lots of opportunity for moving into this space and into the space of our lives with some ease and gentleness. Yesterday, we were talking about this practice of uncertainty and the practice of inclusivity. And one of the things I mentioned is that in the midst of our suffering, we can find these opportunities for joy. We can hold both. And I made the comment about making sure that these are practices for us and not for other people. And I wanted to add, we thought it was funny to think about saying to someone who's in despair, it's like, yes, but there's so many conditions for happiness. But we have to be careful we don't do that to ourselves. When I was training for chaplaincy, I was with one of my coworkers, and there's this impulse inside of us to take away people's difficult feelings, to take them and change them. And that's where that impulse for like, oh, if you just find some joy, you'll be okay, or and we had a little phrase that we used because no one is immune to doing that. You have to be trained. And our joke was saying, your feelings are wrong. Because that's kind of what we're doing when somebody is experiencing difficulty and you want them to experience something else. And kind of saying your feelings are wrong. But how often do we do that to ourselves? How often do we have some difficulty that comes up in our lives? It's like, oh, why am I feeling this? I should be able to feel something different. And so really we're offering that suggestion that the feeling is wrong to ourselves. And so the practice isn't about trying to talk ourselves out of an experience or trying to practice our way out of a feeling. But it's rather to embrace that experience and to open our awareness at the same time to see what else is happening. So it's not that we're trying to get rid of the difficult feeling. We're trying to find a way to transform it right away. But it's a process of allowing, of opening, of connecting to the experience. Because we do know that if we sit with somebody who is experiencing something very difficult, and we just stay there with them, that feeling will transform. In fact, all of our feelings will transform. One of the challenges with a teenager is that, and I'm guessing we were all teenagers once too, so, is that the feeling that they are feeling, the feeling that my son is experiencing, is the only feeling he has ever felt, and it's the only feeling he will ever feel again until it changes. And then it's that. And so we know we can really trust that our experience will transform. We don't have to work too hard to transform it. And in fact, that habit energy we have of trying to transform our experience, trying to use these tools of practice in order to get rid of something, in order to push something away, is just adding more suffering to our experience. It's enough to feel grief. You don't have to feel grief and think, when am I going to stop feeling this? Or, I heard that there's conditions for happiness, so why aren't I happy? It's enough just to experience it. And so I just wanted to clarify that it's so obvious when we do it to other people that we try to talk them out of their feeling or experience, try to get them to change it. It's not quite as obvious when we do it to ourselves. And so just to be gentle with yourself. And to be open to your own experience. One thing that is true is that if we rehearse a situation in our mind, if we recall it or the other direction, anticipate it, and we go over it over and over, the experience that we have from that situation will not change very quickly. It will continue. And that's because we're not being present. It's because we are living in the past or living in the future. And so we're continuing that experience, keeping it alive inside of us, really not giving it the space it needs to transform, not giving it the time, the care that it needs, but rather we're keeping it going. There was a question about over-planning and anxiety, but also balancing that with preparedness, with being ready for something. I can give you two examples. One is an example in the negative, and one is an example in the positive. I had a day where I was working at the hospital. I live really close to the hospital, so I often just bike there because it's, even when it's really icy, it's still easier than trying to find parking. There's a lot of people that drive in. So, but I also had to take my son to an appointment, so I had to get him out of school, bring him to an appointment, and then bring him back to school. And the school's on the other side of town, so I had this thing, it's like, okay, I'm going to bike to work. I'm going to do this. At this time, I'm going to bike home, get the car, drive, get the kid, go to the appointment, drive him back, you know, the whole thing. And then get my bike, go back to work. And so that was my plan. And I was like, great, got it. And then for about a week before, I kept going over the plan. Okay, so I'm going to do this. And then I'm going to do this. Got it. And then, you know, a little while later, it's like, okay, now this day I'm going to do it. And it just kept coming. Just kept going over and over and over the plan. And so the day arrived, and I was at work, and I had done the first step. I biked to work. And then I was going, okay, and then at this time, I'm going to go home. And I stopped myself, and I said, okay, this is silly. I've been living this day now for a week. And so I did just what I suggested. I asked myself, what am I doing right now? And suddenly, everything fell away. I was just walking. That's what I was doing. The plan was there. The plan was going to either work or not. I mean, you could always get a flat tire. The plan was still there, but I wasn't until I took that time to stop and just be there. So a more helpful approach may have been to know that all these things were coming, to take the time to sit, to find some stability, find some ease, and then say, okay, what do I need to do? Done. That's it. It's like I have the timing, I have the experience, the understanding that things can change, and then I don't have to live it over and over. So it's a process of using our imagination in the present, being rooted in the present. All those times I had been imagining, I wasn't actually present. I was trying to live in the future. And so an example of where this did happen is Gina and I were talking about planning this. And to be fair, she had done most of the legwork. But we were thinking about the schedule and thinking about, okay, at this time, you know, do we want to have this amount of transition time or go right in? And so instead of being like, oh yeah, okay, we'll do that, and then thinking, okay, now we're going to have this, now we're going to have that, just stopped and imagined being here with you all. And, you know, it's different now than it was when we imagined it, but here we are. But we could still kind of project a little bit into the future from the present and think, what's going to serve? And then make a decision, write it down, and move on. So we didn't have to carry the plan with us the whole time. We didn't have to go, well, I didn't have to go over it and over it. But I know that Gina didn't either. So there's a way of finding this balance, but it's rooted in the present by thinking about where we are right now and then doing as much preparation as we can and then releasing that into the future and coming back to the present. Part of it is taking the time to actually do that. So often, you know, we're kind of rehearsing it in our minds because we haven't actually taken the time to just kind of sit with it and be with it and experience it. And likewise, we can go back into the past in the same way. We can maintain ourselves in the present and then recall things from the past to experience them or to kind of turn them over and reflect on them. But it's rooted here in the present, in our present experience. And that way, when we start getting wrapped up in the story about what happened or what is going to happen, we can be like, what is happening right now? Okay. I'm here. Okay. Now I can think about the next thing. And this practice works with our present as well. Being present helps us experience the present. Yeah. What I mean by that is, when we're experiencing something very powerful and overwhelming, whether it's joy or awe or sorrow or grief, coming into our present moment and just really allowing that experience to be just as it is, right here, right now, rather than getting lost in what brought the situation about or where it's going to go. You can embrace this present experience. For this practice, especially when there's a really powerful feeling, I have found that mindfulness of the body is very critical. And as I mentioned yesterday, our body is always present. Yeah. We have the gift of time travel with our mind, where we can go into the future or the past. Is it the wood drake without the forethought of grief? It's very present. I love that, just as an aside, I love that Wendell Berry doesn't mention that the wood drake doesn't experience grief. They're just not troubled with the forethought of grief. But this practice of mindfulness of the body, and in the sutra on the four establishments of mindfulness, they talk about mindfulness of the body in the body. So it's not kind of outside, it's experiencing it from within, just whatever it is. Can allow that space of holding our experience. We have to be careful though, because as I mentioned, we often want to use that practice to get rid of our experience, especially if it's painful. Yeah. So it's like, okay, I'm going to do mindfulness of the body so I can stop being mindful of whatever my body's experiencing, and because I want it to change. It will change. Especially if we don't feed it a story, if we don't go over whatever brought it about in our mind. So these ways of experiencing our past, our future, and our present, rooted in the actual experience of our present, and then supported by our mindfulness of the body. It's one of the reasons that guided relaxation is not just a practice of rest, which it is, but it's also a practice of kind of waking up to the experience of our body so that we can find refuge there when we need it, even when our body is not experiencing comfort, even when we're experiencing discomfort, pain. And as we become more familiar with and comfortable with finding that refuge of the body, from within the body, we can start to broaden our awareness out a little bit more to kind of the contents of our feeling, of our feelings. In that same sutra, they go through that's the second establishment of mindfulness, the feelings in the feelings. They really break it down into positive, negative, and neutral feelings. I had this, before I was even introduced to this practice, I was living in South Korea for a couple of years, and some friends and I, during a break, traveled to Macau, which is at that time was a Portuguese colony off of China. And Macau, one of the things it's famous for is casinos. And and really kind of a lot of wealth that would come for those casinos. And so we went to a casino, And you know, I think I had like $20, and I was doing really well, actually. I was playing blackjack and I was winning. I was like, oh, this is great, you know. And it was funny because I never really liked gambling before that. In fact, you know, because I would get really anxious and nervous at the thought of losing. And what I noticed was, while I was playing and winning it, and that my body felt the same as it did when I lost. It was the same racing heart, the same kind of sweaty hands and flushed feeling, and that like that buzzing that you get. And I was like, oh my goodness, this is exactly how I feel when I lose. And I don't like that feeling then either. And I don't really like this feeling now. So I stopped. But it was a really powerful kind of awakening that it was just circumstance and context an interpretation of the experience that told me whether it was negative or positive. By the way, that's you can use it in the other direction. So if you're ever nervous for something, you can tell yourself that you're just excited because it feels the same, and you can interpret it as, oh, it's excitement. That's not so bad. But the experience in the body is the same. And so this mindfulness of the body can really help ground our experience and strip away some of that interpretation. It can be a guide for us. And that mindfulness of that feeling of how we're interpreting it. Is this an experience I'm grabbing onto? Is this an experience I'm pushing away? Thich Nhat Hanh talks about neutral feelings we can actually use to transform into positive experience, into gratitude. The example he gives is the non-toothache. If you've ever had a toothache, you know how awful it is. And if you're not experiencing a toothache right now, well, that's a cause of celebration. That's some gratitude. And we have a lot of non-experiences. So we can incorporate that into our awareness of the causes and conditions for happiness. We can use our experience not to minimize the present, not to minimize our experience of the present. And what I mean by not to minimize is, you know, when you have a painful experience, often our reflex is, well, at least I'm not fill in the blank. That's kind of starting to minimize our experience, not really honoring it. But we can recall those times when we did have a painful experience and that we don't at the moment. And that's a really wonderful thing, to just be able to be here. I was walking with a friend and in the neighborhood, and someone's dome light was on in their car, and so the door was unlocked, so we opened it and turned the light off and closed the door. So, oh, they'll be happy in the morning. And my friend's like, no, they won't. And it's so true, because you don't have the expectation that it's going to be, right? They weren't celebrating the non-dead battery. But it's an important reminder of all these little things that do go well in our day. So many, so many. And especially if we've had or heard of experiences that weren't going well. And so as we begin to kind of really root ourselves in that mindfulness of body and starting to root ourselves in the mindfulness of our experience, that pushing and pulling, grasping, trying to get rid of experiences or replace them with other ones, just noticing what they are. And we start to have a lot of freedom. We start to taste this, what it's like to just be. And then we can start to broaden our mindfulness to incorporate the third foundation of mindfulness, which is mindfulness of the mind, in the mind. We're always body in the body, feelings in the feelings, in the mind, in the mind. Mind here can mean a couple of different things. It's not just kind of the contents of our thinking, but it's also the filter that we're experiencing the world through. So it's, you can imagine a glass of clear water, and mind could be whatever color is added to it. It starts to bring in that interpretation. That experience in Macau is a wonderful example of the mind and being mindful of the mind in the mind. So noticing that, oh, it's just interpretation. It's just telling me what this experience is. And because it's a positive tint to that clear water, you know, the mind is grabbing onto it and saying, let's get some more of this. This is great. And then the opposite experience, you know, when the mind is pushing it away. It's like, oh, let's get rid of this. Push that away. And just like with the mindfulness of the body and the feelings in the feelings, our mindfulness of the mind in the mind, you start to just observe how its activity, how its tint is moving and changing and grabbing onto our experiences, pushing our experiences away, trying to create new experiences, trying to tell ourselves that your feeling is wrong, or telling ourselves that it's okay. And this is where, at this place in this mindfulness practice, this is where the practice of not knowing or the practice of uncertainty can really open up some space for us to be mindful of the mind in the mind. Roshi Bernie Glassman, who's the founder of the Zen Peacemaker Order, has written down three tenets, and the first is called not knowing. Other Zen circles, they sometimes call it the don't know mind. And Thich Nhat Hanh always, who likes to not tell us where we're going to end up, which is not knowing or don't know, but likes to tell us how to get there, calls it the am I sure practice. Am I sure? And it's not to introduce doubt. I think a lot of us have enough self-doubt. But it's a practice to open up possibility. When we're in a situation and we notice that our mind is like starting to solidify, starting to grab onto the experience, then we can say, am I sure? And open up some space. And that's just to also that kind of practice, that not knowing or don't know mind or am I sure, is really laying a foundation. It's not the end practice. And what I mean by that is sometimes we can just stop there and just stop with not knowing or stop with, am I sure? Well, no. Okay, so now what? What's the next part of that? Right? That's to open the space. That's what that practice is for. And the second tenet of Roshi Glassman's Zen Peacemaker Order is bearing witness. We might know it as just mindfulness. And I know that we were talking about mindfulness before. These things aren't necessarily a sequence. They feed each other. But this bearing witness or mindfulness of what is actually happening. Our minds are so good at telling us what is happening. So the invitation is to quiet the mind a little bit, to clear that glass of water, remove a little bit of that tint by asking, am I sure? And then the next part is to look carefully and deeply at what is actually happening. And what are all the places that I'm assuming things or interpreting things? Where are all the places that people are assuming or interpreting about me? And this practice of mindfulness, of bearing witness, helps us to move on to the next step of the three tenets, which is loving action. Sometimes we're not going to ever be sure, right? Am I sure? Probably not. I'm probably not going to have all the information and know everything and experience everything. But I can see that there's suffering somewhere. So, you know, I'll do my best and step forward with loving action. But it's from a different place. It's not a place of reactivity. It's a place of responsiveness. It's a place of deep connection. And then it continues, though. It goes back. So we engage in loving action. And often you might feel that little hook of, oh, my action is loving, so now I'm going to get this result. So then we reintroduce that practice of not knowing to slow our attachment to expectation, to outcome, to really slow down that desire for a specific outcome. I think AA has the phrase that expectation is just premeditated resentment. And it's so accurate. When you set up an expectation and it's not met, you're resentful. So you're really just premeditating the resentment. Doesn't feel like it. When I was new to this practice. I was teaching preschool, and would come back from a weekend retreat and show up on Monday, and just think like, oh, I'm gonna just really, you know, settle these 3-year-olds into the present moment. It's gonna be so wonderful. So you know, we sit down together, and then you know, this kid's like rolling around on their back, and that kid's like, who knows what they're doing? And you know, it's, oh, you know, sit up, dear one, right? and then that kid's like doing some like elbowing, you know, and it's just chaos, which it always is. This feeling of irritation arises. Why aren't they responding to my lovely presence that I've cultivated? And then I start getting frustrated. And it's just such a perfect example of that expectation. You know, I'm going to practice these children into being so present and mindful. But we do that to ourselves too. I'm going to practice myself into this perfect experience of mindfulness, when really I'm just rolling around on my back. maybe inside, maybe outside. It's really powerful to introduce to this feeling, experience of not knowing, of am I sure, continuously, okay, so that we're not attached to a particular outcome. And with work, with all the work that we're doing right now facing climate change, with all the work we're doing facing divisiveness, with all the work we're doing caring for suffering, for people who are displaced and forgotten because of war, because of climate, this practice of no expectation of outcome is very helpful. Because it allows us to move forward, to continue moving forward without carrying so much sorrow, without that forethought of grief. Doesn't mean we're directionless. We still have a clear direction, which is to ease suffering, maybe even to end suffering. That's what the Buddha promised with this path. So we always have that as our guide, that movement towards easing and ending suffering. Our own and the world's. And we can introduce this letting go of expectation, to tend to what it is that we can tend to. It's the same practice we talked about yesterday. What is happening right now? And can I do something? Not should I do something, or should I be doing something? Not suffering, but can I do something with a free heart, aware of the body, aware of the feelings, aware of the mind? And this is the fourth establishment of mindfulness, which is mindfulness of consciousness, or the way it's written in the sutra, the objects of mind, in the objects of mind. So it's how we're engaging with the world. It's how we are mindful of what is happening around us, not just inside of us, but in taking into account the situation around us, and how that is going back in through and coloring our experience of mind and our feelings and our body. And so it's this flow of connection between all of these things, the things that are outside, and sometimes they have an experience inside, and it can be vice versa. There are times when we are just completely drained, completely exhausted for whatever reason. It could be simply because we're ill. It could be because we've encountered enough suffering for the day. It could be because we've scheduled ourselves very tightly and lived that schedule for 2 weeks before the event, and are there and are just completely worn out. And the body needs rest in that time. What will happen is the body will want, will need rest, and will be trying to find that place. And if we kind of keep pushing it, pushing the body, it will have that effect of starting to color our experience of positive, negative, neutral, and then eventually into our mind, where soon everything is going to look like a burden. Everything's going to look like more, more, more. And so when we encounter the objects of mind, that is the world, it's going to look like a burden. Even you know, the loving presence of a friend will look like just more engagement. I just can't do it. It'll have that tint. And so that is a, if we have the means to do that, that's the time to really take care of ourselves. To really find some way of resting, and to just let our exhaustion be. We don't have to make it be something different. And in fact, the more we try to make it something different, the more exhausted we'll become, because now we're just adding more to it. And so it's important to bring a little intentionality to whatever it is we're doing. Sometimes we don't even have the capacity to be with our exhaustion. One of my favorite stories I've shared in here before was that I was visiting with a woman who had two young children and was going through a divorce, and she was maxed out, so emotionally, physically, because the kids have a lot of demands. And she said, you know I'm supposed to, which is a red flag. I know I'm supposed to just be with these feelings. She's like, but all I want to do is just put on Van Morrison records, which is perfect. It's perfect. It's bringing that intentionality. It's finding that way of release, of nurturing, of watering the good seeds, watering the positive seeds. And so we need to be gentle with ourselves. You know, it's like we hear all of these things like, oh yeah, I gotta be with this feeling and practice and do more. I'm not doing enough. Sometimes it's okay just to, you know, put on the radio and just let go into that moment. Just let it be. To sit and stare into space for a moment. You know, we can do that. Our mindfulness, even if it goes away for a little bit when we engage in that practice, it'll be back. And in fact, we're creating the conditions so that it can come back gently and thoroughly. So it's really critical that we take care of ourselves, to notice when we're maxed out. And to remember some of our experience that we've had here this weekend, and will continue to have, that kind of gentle, open concentration that we cultivated with our mindfulness practice, with our meditation practice, of awareness of the whole body, awareness that kind of expands out into the room, starts to fill the room. That kind of gentle, open experience. Because I know when I'm feeling overburdened, either because I am or because I'm making myself that way, it doesn't really matter why. And then I try to do this practice of mindfulness. It's a really tight grasping practice. And because there's a little bit of an expectation hooked in there, which is that I'm going to be aware of this and so that it can transform. It's also that expectation of, oh, I know how to do this. You know, I've been training for this, all that. But then softening our heart, softening our mind, softening our expectation of what to do and how to be, just being. It's amazing to me how hard that is, to just be. I think it's why we come on retreats, so we can practice it, so we can start to learn it. Not knowing, that practice of am I sure, is a deep practice of trust. Trusting in many things at once. Trusting in the present moment, to be the present moment. Trusting in our own capacity to experience the present moment just as it is. And also trusting that we will be able to step forward with that loving action, trusting that we'll be able to engage in the world. Notice I didn't say trusting that we'll get it right, but trusting that we will be able to act with care, with love, with the intention of easing suffering, but not the expectation that we will ease suffering, because we might mess up, say the wrong thing, or do the wrong thing. It's okay, because there's the next moment too, where we can be mindful of, oops, that was the wrong thing, and step into that place. One of my personal practices, sometimes I'll be sitting on the cushion and I'll wonder, how come I'm not fully trusting the present moment? How come I'm not trusting that just this is enough? And then the koan, koans are, it's a Japanese word, comes from a Zen practice, originated with the Chinese Zen or Chan master, Lin Chi, of which the Plum Village tradition is a spiritual descendant of Lin Chi. And this practice of koans is deep questions that are unanswerable. They're unanswerable because they keep unfolding, and they keep us very engaged with our practice. And so the koan that I come up with, that I came up with and use quite frequently, is just, what is holding me back? That's it. Just sitting with that question. It's not a question that I'm going to answer with my mind. I could probably come up with some things. But it's a question of introducing curiosity and investigation and introducing openness to the experience. Another way of looking at those koan practices is asking or introducing not knowing. Am I sure? They're the same kind of idea, because they're trying to get us out of our kind of analytical and expectant mind and into more of a experiential and present flow of mind. And so you can probably come up with your own koan that guides your life. We all have these unwritten rules and scripts in our mind that are running all of the time. Like, when I'm feeling maxed out and I try to practice my way through it, it's like, who told me to do that? Nobody. Nobody told me to do that. Nobody even told me that was a good idea. It was just a script that I ran, just an idea that I started to think was true. We have so many of these from our childhood, from our families, from our culture that we have grown up in. So I love, you know, when people are new to this practice, you know, the question comes up, like, why do we bow? But you notice no one ever says, like, why do we have bells? And I think it's partly because, you know, one, I don't know, it's just, we have this idea of bowing. We don't necessarily have an idea of a bell that's cultural, but we have this cultural idea about bowing and what that means. And so that introduces some interesting places inside of us. It's, ooh, what's that? But we don't have that same association with a bell. And so it doesn't bring up that question. So we all have these kind of scripts that are running underneath, kind of. And so sometimes when we are finding ourselves piling more stuff on top of an already difficult experience, we can ask ourselves, well, where did that come from? Whose is that? Mm. one of my favorite practices is just because I think it doesn't mean it's true. And that can really help to unlock some of this, this expectation that we put on ourselves as we move through our world. And so my intention today was to talk about the seven factors of awakening. But I guess the four establishments of mindfulness felt a little more appropriate. However, we have touched on the first two factors of awakening, which is mindfulness is the first one. The second one is investigation of Dharma. Dharma here, small d, that is experience. And also capital D, Dharma, the teachings, investigation. But I hope that our understanding of investigation is not an intellectual pursuit. It's an investigation of how our mindfulness of body, feelings, mind, and consciousness, how our mindfulness of those things and what is happening in those things is creating our experience. And then investigating also kind of what these rules and scripts are that are holding us back. What are our expectations? Not just for ourselves, but for the world. And the other factors of awakening just kind of fall into place after we start bringing those things in. The reason I wanted to talk about it is it ends with the seventh factor is equanimity. But you can already kind of see how you get there just through the first two. You know, there's this way of opening more to experience, being more inclusive. The other translation of upeksha, of equanimity, is inclusiveness. So my hope for all of us and my hope for the world is that we can learn to be with others, to really be with them, to be with ourselves, to really trust the process of transformation. And that little by little, we can ease and end suffering in the world. That is the work of a bodhisattva. The bodhisattvas were introduced into Mahayana Buddhism, which is kind of the reformation of Buddhism. And part of the reason they were introduced was that there was a lot of focus at the time, not necessarily what the Buddha taught, but at the time, hundreds of years later, a lot of focus on personal liberation, personal ending of suffering, personal freedom. And the Mahayana, one of the insights that they brought forward was that if there's suffering in the world, then I am not free of suffering. And so the invitation then is to ease and end suffering, not just in oneself, but in the world. And so our practice is really about finding ways of engaging in that loving action, rooted in not knowing, rooted in bearing witness of mindfulness. And acting with the intention of easing. If you remember that 15th tenet, we talked a lot about yesterday about the awareness of suffering so that we can also be aware of the conditions for happiness. But it went on to say, awareness of suffering also helps prevent the creation of wrong actions and the planting of negative seeds that bring about suffering. So our awareness of suffering and our intention and desire to ease suffering helps us to not create more suffering through wrong action. When somebody says something to us that we dislike, maybe even they have the intention of saying something that we dislike. And awareness of suffering can help us so that we don't engage in the action of creating more suffering by reacting to that thing. Doesn't mean we never respond to it. Just means that we have a little pause so that we don't react, and then we can say, wow, that was really painful. It's a very beautiful path that we walk together, and it's really reminding me of the importance of community, of Sangha, of being together. It reminds me of how valuable it is to take the time to experience these things. Whatever our experience is, it's experiencing it in a new way, in a beautiful way, in a beautiful place, with people who bring their whole selves, all of their suffering and all of their potential for transformation, and all of their insight and awakening. It's a real gift.